There we go. All right, so as I was saying, our theme this next month or so is God and what we think about God, if we do think about him, or is it necessary to think about him or her. And my task was to present some Unitarian background on thinking about this question, and so I decided to take a bit of a risk today. I'm going to impersonate Emerson. I'm going to give you a heavy dose of Unitarianism. And I'm going to actually read to you a truncated version of the Divinity School address. So I want you to go back in time. It's 1838, it's July 15th. You are in the little Divinity School chapel above Harvard Divinity School's building in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a small group. There are six graduate students and their families and the most noted Unitarians of the day. And the students have been allowed to select their speaker for their graduation ceremony. And they have skipped over the more prominent Unitarian thinkers and theologians, and they have chosen Ralph Waldo Emerson, a young, fairly young preacher in his 30s who has written a book recently called Nature, which has these young ministers to be all on fire. And so they've chosen him. He actually has given up his church some years before and is just making a living as a supply preacher and a thinker and a writer. So I'm going to skip certain sections of it because it's quite long, and I'm going to skip the introduction. But one thing I would put as a kind of footnote is that the Unitarians are at a crux. It's the first generation of Unitarians who have sort of separated themselves from the Congregationalists. Because of their more liberal theology, they have rebelled against Calvinism and its determinism, and they are really very much products of the Enlightenment in the sense that they believe that God must be more more enlightened, more loving than the Calvinist God, and they're very enthralled with the age of Newton, the age of reason. But they're very much Christians, and they're very nervous about that because they have control of all these churches, and they don't want people to think they're not Christians because that would be problematic. So here is a young man who has some radical ideas, and he's going to proclaim them. And the one hint I would say is that in this idea of universal law, all the phenomena of nature have been revealed to be lawful, that underneath the welter of appearances, Newton has shown us that there are laws, simple laws, which govern all of observed reality, then the Romantics believe, of course, the same must be true for the moral world. So with that, let me begin in medias res, as we would say in Emerson's day, in the beginning of things, in the middle of things. The sentiment of virtue is a reverence and a delight in the presence of certain divine laws. It perceives that this homely game of life we play covers under what seem foolish details principles that astonish. The child amidst his baubles is learning the action of light, motion, gravity, muscular force, and in the game of human life, love, fear, justice, appetite, man, and God interact. These laws refuse to be adequately stated. They will not be written out on paper or spoken by the tongue. They elude our persevering thought. Yet we read them hourly in each other's faces, in each other's actions, in our own remorse. The moral traits which are globed into every virtuous act and thought in speech, we must sever and describe or suggest by painful enumeration of many particulars. The intuition of the moral sentiment is an insight of the perfection of the laws of the soul. These laws execute themselves. They are out of time, out of space, and not subject to circumstance. Thus, in the soul of man, there is a justice whose retributions are instant and entire. He who does a good deed is instantly ennobled. He who does a mean deed is by the action itself contracted. He who puts off impurity thereby puts on purity. If a man is at heart just, then insofar is he God, the safety of God, the immortality of God, the majesty of God, do enter into that man with justice. If a man deceive, he deceives himself and goes out of acquaintance with his own being. A man in the view of absolute goodness adores with total humility. Every step so downward is a step upward. The man who renounces himself comes to himself. This sentiment lies at the foundation of society and successively creates all forms of worship. The principle of veneration never dies out. Man fallen into superstition, into sensuality, is never quite without the visions of the moral sentiment. In like manner, all the expressions of this sentiment are sacred and permanent in proportion to their purity. This thought dwelled always deepest in the minds of men in the devout and contemplative East, not alone in Palestine, where it reached its purest expression, but in Egypt, in Persia, in India, in China. Europe has always owed to Oriental genius its divine impulses. What these holy bards said, all sane men found agreeable and true, and the unique impression of Jesus upon mankind, whose name is not so much written as plowed into the history of this world, is proof of a subtle virtue of this infusion. Meantime, whilst the doors of the temple stand open day and night before every man, and the oracles of this truth cease never, it is guarded by one stern condition. This, namely, it is an intuition. It cannot be received at second hand. Truly speaking, it is not instruction, but provocation that I can receive from another soul. What he announces, I must find true in me, or wholly reject, and on his word, or as his second, be he who he may, I can accept nothing. On contrary, the absence of this primary faith is the presence of degradation. As is the flood, so is the ebb. Let this faith depart, and the very words it spake and the things it made become false and hurtful. Then falls the church, the state, art, letters, life. And because the indwelling Supreme Spirit cannot wholly be got rid of, the doctrine of it suffers this perversion that the divine nature is attributed to one or two persons and denied to all the rest and denied with fury. The doctrine of inspiration is lost. The base doctrine of the majority usurps the place of the doctrine of the soul. Miracles, prophecy, poetry, the ideal life, the holy life, exist as ancient history merely. They are not in the belief, nor in the aspiration of the society, but when suggested seem ridiculous. These general views find abundant illustration in the history of religion, and especially in the history of the Christian church, in that all of us have had our birth and nurture. The truth contained in that you, my young friends, are now setting forth to teach. As the cultus, the cult or established authority of the civilized world, it has great historical interest for us. Of its blessed words, which have been the consolation of humanity, you need not that I should speak. I shall endeavor to discharge my duty to you on this occasion by pointing out two errors in its administration, which daily appear more gross from the point of view we have just now taken. Jesus Christ belonged to the true race of prophets. He saw with open eye the mystery of the soul. Drawn to its severe harmony, ravished with its beauty, he lived in it and had his being there. Alone in all history, he estimated the greatness of man. One man was true to what is in you and me. He saw that God incarnates himself in man and evermore goes forth anew to take possession of his world. He said in this jubilee of sublime emotion, I am divine. Through me God acts. Through me he speaks. Would you see God? See me. Or see thee when thou thinkest as I now think. But what a distortion did this doctrine and memory suffer in the same and in the next and following ages. The understanding caught in this high chant from the poet's lips and said in the next age, "This was Jehovah come down from heaven, and I will kill you if you say he was a man." The idioms of his language, the figures of his rhetoric, have usurped the place of his truth, and churches are not built on his principles, but on his tropes. Christianity became a mythos, a myth as the poetic teaching of Greece and Egypt before. He spoke of miracles, for he felt that man's life was a miracle, and that all that man doth, and he knew that this daily miracle shines as the character ascends. But the word miracle, as pronounced by Christian churches, gives a false impression. It is monster. It is not one with the blowing clover and the falling rain. He felt respect for Moses and the prophets, but no unfit tenderness at postponing their initial revelations to the hour and the man that now is, to the eternal revelation in the heart. Thus was he a true man. Having seen that the law in us is commanding, he would not suffer it to be commanded. Boldly, with hand and heart and life, he declared it was God. Thus is he, as I think, the only soul in history who has appreciated the true worth of a man. In this point of view, we become very sensible of the first defect of historical Christianity. Historical Christianity has fallen into the error that corrupts all attempts to communicate religion. As it appears to us, and as it has appeared to the ages, it is not the doctrine of the soul, but an exaggeration of the personal, the positive, the ritual. It dwells with noxious exaggeration about the person of Jesus. The soul knows no persons. It invites every man to expand to the full circle of the universe and will have no preferences but those of spontaneous love. But by this Eastern monarchy of a Christianity, which indolence and fear have built, the friend of man is made the injurer. All who hear me feel that the language that describes Christ to Europe and America is not the style of friendship and enthusiasm to a good and noble heart, but is appropriated and formal, paints a demigod as the Orientals or Greeks would describe Osiris or Apollo. Except the injurious impositions of our early catechism, and even honesty and self-denial were splendid sins if they did not wear the Christian name. One would rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn than to be defrauded of his manly right in coming into nature and finding virtue and truth foreclosed and monopolized. You shall not be a man, even. You shall not own the world. You shall not dare and live after the infinite law that is in you, and in company with that infinite beauty which heaven and earth reflect to you in all lovely forms. But you must subordinate your nature to Christ's nature, and you must accept our interpretation and take his portrait as the vulgar drawer. That is always best, which gives me to myself. The sublime is excited in me by the great stoical doctrine, obey thyself. That which shows God in me fortifies me. That which shows God out of me makes me a wart and a wind. There is no longer a necessary reason for my being. The divine bards are the friends of my virtue, of my intellect, of my strength. They admonish me that the gleams which flash across my mind are not mine, but God's. That they had the like, and were not disobedient to the heavenly vision. So I love them. Noble provocations go out from them, inviting me to resist evil, to subdue the world, and to be. And thus, by his holy thoughts, Jesus serves us, and thus only. To aim to convert a man by miracles is a profanation of the soul. A true conversion, a true Christ, is now, as always, to be made by the reception of beautiful sentiments. It is true that a great and rich soul like his, falling among the simple, does so preponderate that, as his did, it names the world. The world seems to them to exist for him, and they have not yet drunk so deeply of his sense as to see that only by coming again to themselves or to God in themselves can they grow forevermore. It is a low benefit to give me something. It is a high benefit to enable me to do somewhat of myself. The time is coming when all men will see that the gift of God to the soul is not a vaunting, overpowering, excluding sanctity, but a sweet and natural goodness, a goodness like thine and mine, and that so invites thine and mine to be and to grow. The second defect of the traditionary and limited way of using the mind of Christ is a consequence of the first, this namely, that the moral nature, the law of laws, whose revelations introduce greatness, yes, God himself into the open soul, is not explored as the foundation, as the fountain of the established teaching in society. Men have come to speak of the revelation as somewhat long ago given and done, as if God were dead. The injury to faith throttles the preacher, and the goodliest of institutions becomes an uncertain and inarticulate voice. And now, my brothers, you will ask, what in these desponding days can be done by us? The remedy is already declared in the ground of our complaint of the church. We have contrasted the church with the soul. In the soul, then, let the redemption be sought. Wherever a man comes, there comes revolution. The old is for slaves. When a man comes, all books are legible, all things transparent, all religions are forms. He is religious. Man is the wonder worker. He is seen amid miracles. All men bless and curse. He saith yea and nay only. The stationariness of religion, the assumption that the age of inspiration is past, that the Bible is closed, the fear of degrading the character of Jesus by representing him as a man, indicate with sufficient clearness the falsehood of our theology. It is the office of a true teacher to show us that God is, not was, that he speaketh, not spake. The true Christianity, a faith like Christ's in the infinitude of man, is lost. None believeth in the soul of man, but only in some man or person old and departed. Ah me, no man goeth alone. All men go in flocks to this saint or that poet, avoiding the God who seeth in secret. They cannot see in secret. They love to be blind in public. They think society wiser than their soul, and know not that one soul, and their soul, is wiser than the whole world. See how nations and races flit by on the sea of time and leave no ripple to tell where they floated or sunk, and one good soul shall make the name of Moses or Zeno or Zoroaster reverend forever. None assayeth the stern ambition to be the self of the nation and of nature, but each would be an easy secondary to some Christian scheme or sectarian connection or some eminent man. Once leave your own knowledge of God, your own sentiment, and take secondary knowledge, as St. Paul's or George Fox's or Swedenborg's, and you get wide from God with every year this secondary form lasts. And if, as now, for centuries, the chasm yawns to that breadth that men can scarcely be convinced there is in them anything divine, let me admonish you, first of all, to go alone, to refuse the good models, even those which are sacred in the imagination of men, and dare to love God without mediator or veil. Friends enough you shall find who will hold up to your emulation Wesleys and Oberlins and saints and prophets. Thank God for these good men, but say, I also am a man. Imitation cannot go above its model. The imitator dooms himself to hopeless mediocrity. The inventor did it because it was natural to him, and so in him it has a charm. In the imitator, something else is natural, and he bereaves himself of his own beauty to come short of another man's. Yourself, a newborn bard of the Holy Ghost, cast behind you all conformity and acquaint men at first hand with the deity. Look to it first and only that fashion, custom, authority, authority, pleasure, and money are nothing to you, are not bandages over your eyes that you cannot see. But live with the privilege of the immeasurable mind. When you meet men or women in your parish, be to them a divine man. Be to them thought and virtue. Let their timid aspirations find in you a friend. Let their trampled instincts be genially tempted out in your atmosphere. Let their doubts know that you have doubted, and their wonder feel that you have wondered. By trusting your own heart, you shall gain more confidence in other men. For all our penny wisdom, for all our soul-destroying slavery to habit, it is not to be doubted that all men have sublime thoughts, that all men value the few real hours of life. They love to be heard. They love to be caught up into a vision of principles. We mark with light in the memory the few interviews we have had in the dreary years of routine and of sin with souls that have made our souls wiser, that spoke what we thought, that told us what we knew, that gave us leave to be what we inly were. Discharge to men the priestly office, and present or absent, you shall be followed with their love as by an angel. And now, let us do what we can to rekindle the smoldering, nigh-quenched fire on the altar. The evils of the church that now is are manifest. The question returns, what shall we do? I confess, all attempts to project and establish a cultus with new rites and forms seem to me vain. Faith makes us, and not we it, and faith makes its own forms. All attempts to contrive a system are as cold as the new worship introduced by the French to the goddess of reason, today pasteboard and filigree, and ending tomorrow in madness and murder. Rather, let the breath of new life be breathed by you through the forms already existing, for if once you are alive, you shall find they shall become plastic and new. The remedy to their deformity is first soul, and second soul, and evermore soul. A whole popedom of forms, one pulsation of virtue, can uplift and vivify. Two inestimable advantages Christianity has given us. First, the Sabbath, the jubilee of the whole world whose light dawns welcome alike into the closet of the philosopher, into the garret of toil, into the prison cells, and everywhere suggests, even to the vile, the dignity of spiritual being. Let it stand forevermore a temple, which new love, new faith, new sight shall restore to more than its first splendor to mankind. And secondly, the institution of preaching, the speech of man to man, essentially the most flexible of all organs, of all forms. What hinders that now everywhere in pulpits, in lecture rooms, in houses, in fields, wherever the invitation of men or your own occasions lead you, you speak the very truth as your life and conscience teach it, and cheer the waiting, fainting hearts of men with new hope and new revelation. I look for the hour when that supreme beauty which ravished the souls of those Eastern men, and chiefly of those Hebrews, and through their lips spoke oracles to all time, shall speak in the West also. The Hebrew and Greek scriptures contain immortal sentences that have been bread of life to millions. But they have no epical integrity, are fragmentary, are not shown in their order to the intellect. I look for the new teacher that shall follow so far those shining laws, that he shall see them come full circle, shall see their rounding complete grace, shall see the world to the mirror of the soul, shall see the identity of the law of gravitation with purity of heart, and shall show that the ought, that duty, is one thing with science, with beauty, and with joy. Thank you. The chief Unitarian periodical of the time, the Christian Examiner, stated that Emerson's comments, so far as they are intelligible, are utterly distasteful to the instructors of the school and to Unitarian ministers generally, by whom they are esteemed to be neither good divinity nor good sense. He was branded an atheist and was forbidden to speak at Harvard for 20 more years. So there you have it, in his original words. Any thoughts?
What I heard was the need to nourish the soul. And I think that's a real question to open up and dig into.
That's, yeah, that was what he was all about, that's for sure. Yeah.
When I was in sixth grade, I was grappling with the idea of God, and I remember sitting downstairs with my brother Adrian, and we were talking about it. And I said, well, you know, like when you were in kindergarten and you were making art, and you just poured yourself into that art so that if somebody didn't like it, it hurt you so deeply. But if somebody praised it, you were part of that art. I said, maybe it's the same with God, and that we are God, at which point he told me that I was a Satanist. and there began my
your descent
downward spiral. So I could really relate. And over again while you were speaking, I was like, but we are so afraid of listening to the inner voice. We have become conditioned, or maybe we're afraid because we have bad thoughts sometimes, to trust the burning instinct of pure love or whatever it is. It's maybe not Minnesotan to consider the divinity inside us.
And one of the things that I find most intriguing about Emerson's whole sort of setup is that there is deepest within you, it's not you at all. But if you go deep enough, it's no longer personal, it's no longer ego. There's something inside you that's much bigger than that. So the deeper you go, the less likely it is that you're going to be just speaking from some crazed, egotistical point of view. That's problematic, of course, because some people do hear voices that say all sorts of crazy things. And it's risky. It's very risky. It's much easier to follow the Ten Commandments and all the catechisms and memorize the rules. Yeah?
Well, it just made me remember two things. One, how much I loved Emerson. In my mind, he's like the king of the one-line quotable quotes. I heard like 10 of them in there that, I want to go back and find and pull out. And the second thing is I just couldn't help but think, as a society, we've really gotten dumber. Can you imagine anywhere other than a Unitarian church where I realize the language construction is different and that kind of thing, but thinking on that level, we just don't do that as a society anymore. It's, we're just too interested in the, I guess the one-liners, unfortunately. But the level of public discourse is so just pathetic.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. One, having my PhD in Emerson, right, I read a lot about the 19th century. And one of the things you really find out is that their level of tolerance for three-hour sermons it was quite high. And not only that, but when they didn't have sermons, they went to Athenaeums and other events where they would actually seek out oratory. That was their main source of entertainment, was listening to beautifully crafted words. And if you look at the...
TV.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
They would go and they'd just listen to somebody speak. They love to do that. Yeah.
Did you know, did anyone here know what Emerson's idea of the soul is? And also the life after death, or the eternal?
It's kind of, complex. But as I was saying, that the idea of the soul, your individual soul, as you go follow it deeper inside yourself, becomes the universal soul. In other words, they're very inspired, as I said at the beginning, by this notion that Newton had had revealed an order in things that was universal. And remember, this was new, you know, the Newton's Principia, you know, which had shown the laws of gravitation and all that kind of stuff, that was new to mankind. And suddenly, wow, nature is full of these hidden laws. And for him, that said there was a universal mind underneath nature. And that mind was also a moral mind. So, you know, that's when you study religion in the 19th century, the romantic theologians really believed you can get in touch with that moral law, just like Newton can get in touch with the physical laws through your intuition, though. You can't argue it. It's not logic, it's intuition. It's for them. And that's, you know, there are a lot of problems with that, but that is really our heritage as Unitarians, that we have that belief. We have principles, not theology.
So is Emerson, though, thinking in terms of an entity, so to speak, when he talks about the soul, or is he talking about some metaphysical something out there, or what?
It's a little hard to nail that down. And you have to go deep into the philosophy of the time, which comes out of Kant and the post-Kantians and all this kind of stuff, and epistemology. It's very complex, but basically what he's really saying is that what they knew and what we still know is that the world is constructed by our perception of it. The world as we experience it is constructed according to laws of the mind. And so when you can't have a human being without moral constructions of some sort, either good or bad morals, that's the way we roll. So it's not so much that you need to find an essence or an entity that you can touch or something that you can say, okay, that there's where it is. It's more like we can't exist without it. It pre-exists us. It makes us possible. Moral law. Yes, Steve.
I was really struck by the tension between the sort of individual inspiration and worship versus the community worship and maybe orthodoxy, and how this is almost 100 years ago and we're still dealing with the same issues, and it's not really that there's a way to solve it. That tension is always there, and you know, at certain times, at least certain churches become very insistent on the orthodoxy, and that leads to problems. But on the other hand, we're still meeting together. We're not just each thinking our own thoughts. We talked about looking in each other's faces and conversing with each other. And that's one thing I really appreciate about this fellowship, is that if we were somewhere in the middle where we do encourage individual thinking, but there, we still have shared principles.
Yeah, yeah.
And we need that voice just as much now as it was needed.
And to tell the truth, you know, whenever I teach, I don't teach Emerson that much, but when I do teach, you'll always get some kid who just goes crazy. And I've occasionally, there's an intersection between libertarians and Emersonians, because the libertarians don't hear the community part because it's not very loud. Because in Emerson's day, that was assumed. Everybody's deeply wired into a community, and you can't get out. Unlike today, you know, I mean, everybody was a member of a church, and you all, you know, in one church, it was in New England, right? So it's pretty much the Congregationalists or the Unitarians. And so you don't hear him talk as much about community, because that's what he's trying to work against. It's stifling him. But notice the two things he'll salvage from Christianity are the Sabbath and preaching. And the Sabbath is interesting, that's the first thing he says, that's the most useful thing. Because we have to have a day where we agree to come together and be together and not just be individual monads. And then preaching, we have to talk to each other. Although it sets him up, of course, for his lecture career. But.
And I think that brings it full around to what Ray noted in the beginning, that idea of nurturing. How do you nurture this God within? And I think this is the place, and I think involvement this place is great part of this community. And there's a line in there talking about the one-liners that Monica mentioned, about doing, something about, I can't do it, but there was just a wonderful line about that God is within you, that you do something with it.
Yeah.
Which goes back to that community piece also.
Yeah, because again, where he most feels God at work is in the moral sentiment. You can't be moral by yourself.
Uh-huh.
It has to be in relationship to other people and what you do with other people. And that's, I think, if you look at our core values, that idea that we can argue all day about whether God is here or there or what God is, but it doesn't matter if we don't do things. If we don't do things to help others, then we're not a religious community. And I think that's, again, kind of the essence of the Unitarian idea.
Yeah, it reminded me quite a lot of social constructionism, that God has to be constantly made and remade in everyday interactions and treatment of others. And it also reminded me of my mother, who very unreligious person, but she went to Catholic school her whole life and then taught Catholic school. And she said she was okay with it because it was first grade, so all she had to teach was God is love. So she felt qualified to talk about that. And so it's just basically that God exists in love for others and moral treatment of others, and so kind of reminded me of hers. So her maiden name is Hagen, and my dad calls her Hagen the Pagan. So it reminded me of Hagen the Pagan.
Michael.
He starts out paying homage to the East.
Yes.
It's very Buddhist what he's saying, I mean, because, you know, what Buddhists have discovered is when you go deeper inside, you meet the universe, and you meet the force of good, the force of compassion. And so you can't go up because you're with the universe. You know, you can test your own intuition against the way that the universe flows. And then he comes back to ground Christ in, you know, that philosophy, which of course all Buddhists would say, of course, Christ and other great religious leaders are Buddhists as well, because they found the right way of, you know, right thinking, the middle way, right livelihood, compassion of life.
Yeah, and it was very exciting at this time because people were reading for the first time the Upanishads and the Buddhist scriptures, and they were really feasting on all these available sources. So that's one reason. And also, if you were in divinity school at that time, you'd sort of play around with the idea that Jesus got some of his philosophy from the East, you know, stuff like that. I'm going to say let's hold the rest of our comments for coffee time, and let's sing a hymn. We're going to sing hymn number 2, verses 1, 2, 6, and 7.